Today is Thursday, February 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, how can the world stop the coronavirus outbreak?
We don't have a vaccine for this one, and we probably won't for at least a year.
Plus, violence in Israel and Palestine following U.S. President Donald Trump's plan for the region. And today is International Day of Zero Tolerance for Female Genital Mutilation. Those stories and more are next. Our top story today, it's been a busy week in U.S. politics. On Monday, Democratic Party voters in the state of Iowa chose their nominee to run against Republican President Donald Trump, although the results are still not clear. Iowa's selection process kicks off a primary election season that will last for months. Wednesday, the Senate acquitted Trump in his impeachment trial without calling any witnesses, and Trump gave a fiery and controversial State of the Union speech, often the most important speech a president makes each year. Earlier Thursday, Trump spoke at what's called the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington. Sagar Magani with the Associated Press reports.
The president was on stage at the annual National Prayer Breakfast, where Harvard professor Arthur Brooks' keynote speech described a crisis of contempt in America and offered advice from Jesus.
He said, love your enemies.
The president smiled.
Arthur, I don't know if I agree with you.
And promptly unloaded.
My family, our great country, and your president have been put through a terrible ordeal by some very dishonest and corrupt people.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was on stage and shook her head. The president had earlier held up copies of newspapers whose banner headlines announced his acquittal. Sagar Magani at the White House.
To wrap up this week and look ahead to what's next in U.S. politics, we have VOA political analyst Jim Malone joining us in the studio today. Hello, Jim. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jason.
So looking at the Iowa selection for the Democratic nominee, it looks like it's split between Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders. And Buttigieg is much more of a centrist, whereas Sanders is much more of a leftist, even a socialist. Is this an accurate view of the Democratic Party nationwide, this split?
I think it is a sort of dynamic theme moving forward in the primary process. I mean, we finally get to the point now, the Iowa returns about 97% in. Basically, it's a tie. So it was good news for Buttigieg this week. He was not expected to do that well. Sanders was expected to probably win, so he's in decent shape. And Elizabeth Warren a little further back, and the big disappointment, Joe Biden in fourth place. And so Biden and others now face a lot of pressure in New Hampshire, which is the next state to vote. That's next Tuesday. It's a primary, a little different organization than the caucus. But we're still going to see two dynamics moving forward, I think, the progressives versus moderates in the party, but also which candidate is the best, the strongest to take on President Trump? That is still the foremost issue in the minds of many Democrats.
Now, New Hampshire is quite a different state than Iowa. It's in the Northeast. It's a smaller state. What issues are voters in New Hampshire going to be thinking about and looking at as they go to the polls soon to select their nominee?
Well, New Hampshire can be a quirky state. One thing about New Hampshire, it's not just Democrats who can vote. Independents can show up and vote in the primary. Not all states allow that. So it adds a little bit of an uncertainty to the mix there. And in the past, sometimes New Hampshire kind of delivers a blow to the favorites for the nomination. That happened to Barack Obama back in 2008 after a big win in Iowa. This time, though, Sanders has been heavily favored in the polls for a long time. But the question will be, can Buttigieg catch up to him? Can Biden mount a comeback? Can Elizabeth Warren restart her campaign with a strong sort of dynamic push? And again, I think the key issue will be Democrats trying to figure out who's the strongest candidate for the general election campaign. So they're auditioning for that. I do think, though, that this campaign is likely to go on for a long time. The results out of Iowa were muddled. We could have a very long Democratic battle. It could go all the way to the convention. We don't know.
Now, looking into D.C. now, it's been a pretty rough week politically, a bruising week with the impeachment acquittal, and you know there's some bitterness on both sides. What's it like now in D.C.?
You know, if you look at the State of the Union, and not everybody around the world watches that, but what was most memorable from this one was not what was said, but the body language. The apparent rebuff of a handshake between the Speaker of the House and the President. The Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, ripping up the President's speech at the end of the address. It just encapsulates, it's almost beyond polarization now, though. Both camps are bitterly dug in. We've had the impeachment vote. It went along party lines for the most part, except for Mitt Romney, a Republican, who voted on one article to convict the President. And now we see the recriminations. We heard the earlier report about the prayer breakfast, and it's an election year. So, unfortunately, we're going to see more of this in the months to come. And let's see more how the President reacts and how the Democrats react to what they see as a political setback.
Last question. With all of this bitterness, with the impeachment acquittal, what might the fallout be on the elections this year?
Right now, it looks like the President's supporters may be motivated from this impeachment battle, but Democrats could be motivated down the line as well. After all, now they see the only way to remove the president from office is in an election. So we'll be watching that very carefully.
That's VOA political analyst Jim Malone in our studio in Washington. Thanks for joining us, Jim.
Yeah, thank you.
NASA astronaut Christina Koch, who has spent nearly 11 months in orbit on the longest spaceflight by a woman, landed safely in Kazakhstan on Thursday, along with two of her International Space Station crewmates. And Turkey sent more reinforcements into northwestern Syria on Thursday, setting up new positions to stop a Syrian government offensive on Idlib province, which is the last rebel stronghold in the war-torn country. You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A trio of Japanese scientists have proposed the possibility that there are thousands of planets orbiting supermassive black holes at the center of some galaxies. Accepted knowledge suggests that planets are formed from protoplanetary disks made up of dust, gas, and other materials left over from the formation of a star. The scientists say that some supermassive black holes also have enormous quantities of similar surrounding material called an accretion disk. It's thought that a supermassive black hole accretion disk could contain as much material that can add up to a mass that is 100,000 times that of the Sun. Tachiro Kokuba, a member of the research team and a professor from the National Astronomical Observatory of Japan, said that the trio's calculations indicate tens of thousands of planets with 10 times the mass of Earth could be formed around 10 light years from a black hole. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Two Palestinians are dead and 16 Israelis wounded amid a sharp increase in Israeli-Palestinian violence following the announcement of U.S. President Donald Trump's plan for the region, which gives large chunks of the West Bank to Israel. The Islamist Hamas movement has called for more attacks to protest Trump's plan while Israeli troops continue operations in occupied Palestine. Journalist Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Some Israeli soldiers were at a popular Jerusalem entertainment area just before they were to be sworn in at the Western Wall when a Palestinian driving a car drove into them, injuring 12. Israeli police said the attacker's car was found nearby, but he has not been apprehended. He is described as a 24-year-old Palestinian from East Jerusalem. Dr. Alon Schwartz, the head of trauma at Jerusalem Shari Tzedek Hospital, said one of the soldiers is in critical condition. Schwartz said the soldier was brought in with a serious head wound and other injuries, was operated on, and is still in intensive care. He says it is hoped that the soldier will improve. A few hours later, a Palestinian opened fire at a soldier in Jerusalem's Old City, the first shooting there in almost 2 years. One soldier was slightly wounded, and the attacker was killed. And in a third attack, in 12 hours, a Jewish settler in the West Bank was slightly wounded in a shooting. Meanwhile, in the West Bank town of Jenin, Israeli troops shot and killed a 19-year-old Palestinian security cadet in unclear circumstances. The soldiers were there to demolish a house of another man who committed a terrorist attack. On Wednesday, Israeli troops shot and killed a 17-year-old Palestinian in Hebron, whom they said threw a firebomb at them. He is being called the first martyr of the Trump plan. Palestinian security official Akram Rajoub said Israel is responsible for the violence.
I'm a Palestinian.
He said that the Palestinian people feel under pressure and have lost hope in the future, and that the Israeli government and U.S. President Donald Trump have made things worse. Israel says it is sending more troops to flashpoints and hope the area will regain calm quickly. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
The Israel-Gaza border has also been shaken by violence. Palestinians have launched mortar fire, rockets, and balloon-borne explosives into Israel, causing panic but no serious casualties. Israel, meanwhile, has carried out nightly airstrikes against Hamas targets. The new coronavirus has spread to more than two dozen countries. The virus began in China, which still has the vast majority of cases and deaths. VOA's Carol Pearson asked experts experienced on disease outbreaks what they would do to stop this one. New York-based Human Rights Watch accuses China of developing a mass surveillance system to monitor and control its population. China figures prominently in the organization's annual report, which examines the human rights situations in more than 90 countries. VOA's Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Human Rights Watch accuses China of developing a mass surveillance system to monitor and control its population. China figures prominently in the agency's annual report, which examines the human rights situation in more than 90 countries. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva. Text in 321. The advocacy group's report says the Chinese people are living through the most intense period of repression since the brutal crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators in Tiananmen Square in 1989. It says the Uyghurs in the northwestern region of Xinjiang province are most victimized. It says more than 1 million people are interned in so-called re-education camps in an effort to erase their Muslim heritage and culture, a claim China denies. Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth says China is establishing a surveillance system unlike any ever seen before. He says that system is mostly used to keep tabs on the movements of the Uyghurs. He says the system is being developed throughout the country.
This massive database is then used to determine who is detained or not. And police officers on the street have access to that database through their handheld devices. So people stopped at checkpoints can be sent off to detention. People's homes actually have barcodes on them so that the police can quickly figure out, you know, how reliable the residents of this home are.
Roth says China censors all criticism at home and is now using its economic power to globalize its censorship system. He says the government is using its ability to control exports to the Chinese market, which represents 16% of the global economy, to get companies abroad to do its bidding.
They've used that threat of denying access to force companies to start to censor their employees. In other words, it has begun to export its censorship system to move the well-established domestic system of censorship abroad and to apply it to people anywhere in the world who might criticize China.
One of the most notorious cases concerns the U.S. National Basketball Association. China threatened to rip up a $1 billion television contract because of a dispute with the NBA over Hong Kong. Roth says China also uses its influence as a superpower to undermine initiatives it does not like on the diplomatic level. He says China uses its veto power in the United Nations Security Council to stop the UN from addressing dire situations in places such as Syria, Myanmar, and Venezuela. He accuses Beijing of doing whatever it can to undermine UN efforts to enforce human rights. He says China does respond to pressure. Countries have shown when they band together, they can successfully defy China. Roth says China cannot retaliate against all countries because it cannot afford to cut off economic relations with the entire world. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Apologies. We'll go back to our story before about the coronavirus outbreak. Here's VOA's Carol Pearson, who spoke to experts experienced on disease outbreaks about what they would do to stop this one.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention helped West African countries successfully end their Ebola outbreak a few years ago. At the time, the CDC was headed by Dr. Tom Frieden. He now heads a global nonprofit organization called Resolve to Save Lives. In a Skype interview, VOA asked him, "How do you end the coronavirus epidemic going on now?"
For each different microbe, we have a different approach. For some, we have vaccines. For some, there are containment measures like SARS or MERS or Ebola, where we can actually stop it. And for some, like flu, we try to mitigate. We try to reduce the damage.
With Ebola, finding people who have had contact with those infected is critical. Ebola spreads through bodily fluids. Contact has to be close. Coronaviruses are airborne, like measles, which means that these viruses can spread more easily through coughing or sneezing. This makes contact tracing much more difficult. Isolation is also key.
Don't go out if you're sick.
But with a widespread virus that has infected more than 20,000 people, that can be a daunting task. Lauren Sauer, director of the Office of Critical Event Preparedness and Response at Johns Hopkins Medicine in Baltimore, spoke to VOA by Skype.
It's hard. It's definitely a really challenging public health question.
The Chinese government has asked people to self-isolate if they don't need hospital care. The government has also quarantined entire cities, which means people who are there are not allowed to leave. Frieden explains.
In public health terms, we call something social distancing. In other words, reducing the amount of contact among people.
There are other things public health experts recommend repeatedly.
Wash your hands, cover your cough.
Everyone needs to wash their hands. Everyone needs to stay home if they're sick.
We don't have a vaccine for this one, and we probably won't for at least a year.
Researchers are working on a vaccine. But for this virus, the public health practices will likely end the outbreak, whether it reaches pandemic stage or not. It's what ended the Ebola outbreak in West Africa and some other epidemics as well. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
Poor villagers in remote Cambodian provinces commonly occupy public lands, hoping to be later granted legal ownership by the authorities. Hundreds of cases in the past have been decided in their favor, but a recent land protest has resulted in a clash with the local military police that killed one of the villagers. The outcry that followed prompted Cambodia's president to order an investigation, and the perpetrators now face over a decade in prison. VOA's Naren Soon spoke to people directly affected by these evictions. Like hundreds of other poor villagers, Sros Toy and his wife Kim Lak Bai had settled on what they thought was public land, hoping that the authorities would grant them ownership of it. Here's Toy's wife, Bai.
Because of the poverty, we asked the government for the land. Following others, we went and occupied the land. My husband just followed everyone else.
The 34-year-old, along with land protesters, were arrested and accused of illegally occupying privately owned lands in Bante Minche, a western province near the Thai border. Sros Toy was taken into custody in late December and died on January 1st. Official reports say his death was due to sickness and alcoholism, but his family disagrees. They allege he was beaten by two military policemen.
I saw the bruises. When my husband left home, he was fine. He was healthy like others. But there were several bruises on his dead body and face. I admitted my husband could drink, but he was not an alcoholic.
After his arrest, Sros Toy was reportedly brutally beaten inside the provincial military police headquarters on December 28th. Ruan An, a fellow prisoner, survived that incident.
The guard said that Srahtoy screamed and ran awkwardly. The police chief ordered, beat him to death, and I will take care of it.
Police violence and land disputes has occurred more frequently in the last decade as land prices have been skyrocketing amidst the country's surging development. The government openly admits failure in resolving land disputes. But in this case, Prime Minister Hun Sen, who was made aware of the torture and death, ordered a swift investigation on January 14th. 4 days later, two military policemen were arrested and charged over intentional violence and death of the victim. They can face up to 15 years in prison. The four surviving victims were released and placed under court supervision. Now they are calling for a complete drop of the private ownership violation charge against them. As for Boy, the widow, she was given $3,000 by anonymous sources for her husband's funeral. February 6th is the International Day of Zero Tolerance for Female Genital Mutilation. The practice, also known as female circumcision or cutting, poses serious health risks, but remains common in many countries, particularly in West Africa. Annika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar.
February 6th is the International Day of Zero Tolerance for Female Genital Mutilation. The practice, also known as female circumcision or cutting, poses serious health risks but remains common in many countries, particularly in West Africa. Annika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar. Excessive bleeding, infection, and even death are just some of the health consequences of female genital mutilation, or FGM. As they enter adulthood, young women who are cut as children may face chronic problems such as mental health disorders and pain during urination or sex. FGM may also cause life-threatening complications during childbirth. Despite these risks, the practice has continued largely in the name of culture and tradition. Some communities believe FGM will prevent premarital sex and ensure a wife's fidelity by reducing her libido. More than 200 million women and girls who are alive today have been cut, according to the World Health Organization. FGM is practiced in 30 countries throughout Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, as well as among migrants from those regions. Within West Africa, the prevalence of FGM ranges from 2% in Niger to 97% in Guinea, according to data from UNICEF. Gambia, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Sierra Leone also have rates at above 75%. Christina Polito is a research scientist with the World Health Organization.
The prevalence is still quite high in a number of countries. There's a lot of variation between countries, even within countries. We do see positive trends of decreased rates of FGM in a number of countries.
26 countries in Africa and the Middle East have laws that prohibit FGM, but legislation can be difficult to enforce and may unintentionally push the practice underground. Amadou Moreau is the founder of Global Research and Advocacy Group, a Senegal-based nonprofit working to end FGM.
For the last 20 years, we have a law against the practice in this country. It's the most controversial law in this country because when you're dealing with people's faith and beliefs and culture and tradition, executive power has no place to guide people on how they should behave, how they should act.
Moreau and Polito said the most effective solutions combine both grassroots efforts and policy change. But it's especially important to engage local communities and address the beliefs that are driving the practice, says the WHO's Polito.
And we do find that people, once they realize that it is harmful, once they realize that by stopping the practice, it can improve health, it can improve the well-being of girls in the community.
She adds that when people know others who have stopped the practice, it can be a very powerful way to bring about change. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his party this week face their first electoral test since deadly anti-government protests erupted nearly 2 months ago, with the divisive turmoil likely to win them votes at polls in the capital. Modi's Hindu nationalist party won a bigger majority in a general election in May, but it has lost a string of state elections since then. The protests, in which at least 25 people have been killed, erupted across the country in mid-December, after Modi's party passed a new citizenship law that critics say violates India's secular constitution. That's it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Patrick Dea, I'm Jason Patinkin. Thank you for listening, and have a great evening.